Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
There's gold fever on the streets of St. Paul.
$1 billion con.
We finally hit the big time.
A jackpot.
There was no sign of anything that was amiss.
Everybody wanted to get rich.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's too good to be true. It's too good to be true.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 27th of May. These are our main stories. Israel faces growing condemnation after an airstrike in Rafah, which Palestinian officials say killed dozens of displaced people. More than 2,000 people are now feared dead after Friday's landslide in Papua New Guinea. The World Health Organization meets to discuss its preparedness for future pandemics. Also in this podcast, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa addresses the nation ahead of elections and...
It's a very, very sad story for me. So I'm definitely not happy about that, but I'm happy it's going back to the museum. This is much more important.
The FBI investigates hundreds of treasures believed to have been stolen from the British Museum. Israel is facing international condemnation over an airstrike in southern Gaza on Sunday that appears to have caused dozens of Palestinian deaths. Israel says the attack successfully targeted two senior Hamas officials at a military compound in Rafah. But after reviewing the incident, it's acknowledged that civilians were killed in a fire that broke out in a nearby refugee camp. Palestinian health officials have said at least 45 people died, many of them children, and more than 200 were wounded. Philippe Lazzarini, the head of UNRWA, the UN agency leading the humanitarian operation in Gaza, told journalists in Beirut that he's disturbed by the incident.
I cannot comment on the casualties because we haven't been able to properly communicate with our team on the ground. I saw images. They are deeply disturbing and horrifying. I think we have been clear more than once. There is no safe space in Gaza.
Israel says it regrets any harm done to civilians. Avi Hyman is a spokesman for the Israeli government.
What happened last night is we went after two high-value Hamas targets, and it appears from initial reports that somehow a fire broke out that sadly took the lives of others. Now, I say it appears too because it is under investigation, and the IDF investigates every accident of this nature to see what actually happened, whereas Hamas runs to the media to tell tales that will help them propaganda-wise.
So Israel is coming under pressure again, as I heard from the BBC's Arab Affairs analyst, Sebastian Usher.
I mean, it's a continuation of really quite bad publicity for Israel in the past week or so. The two rulings that were made by the International Criminal Court, the prosecutor there saying that he was seeking an arrest warrant for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Defence Minister about a week ago, and then the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, ruling, literally ordering Israel to stop its operations in Rafah on Friday. And interestingly, in some of the reactions that there have been to what happened overnight in Rafah, there's been mention of that. The EU main policy head, Josep Borrell, said that Israel must follow that ruling as soon as possible. We've had very strong call from Emmanuel Macron, the French president, saying he's outraged by what happened. So, as I say, this is really a continuation of the way that the general feeling across the international community, and that includes most of Israel's Western allies, seems to be turning more and more against the actions that the Israeli government is taking at the moment.
And do you think that there could be ramifications for the peace talks which are scheduled for tomorrow?
I think there's still some uncertainty over quite how far any kind of resumption of the peace talks is headed at the moment. I mean, there was optimism that's been expressed by the US and on the Israeli side that things may be picked up again this week. But Hamas has essentially said that it hasn't seen anything new in the offers. And what we've heard as a result of what happened in Rafah overnight from two of the main mediators, Egypt and Qatar. First of all, condemnation, but from Qatar in particular, saying that what's happened could complicate any mediation efforts. As I say, I mean, I don't think there was huge optimism that there would be any major move in the short term. But of course, there's always hope that the continuation of the talks will at some point lead to an actual deal that can be put into practice, which would see at least some Israeli hostages released, a much larger number of Palestinian prisoners held in Israel freed as well, and a ceasefire of at least 6 weeks. We've heard that many times, though, and I think that people who are following this are now very cautious about any kind of sense that this could be coming soon.
Sebastian Usher. Aid agencies in Papua New Guinea say they're struggling to reach those buried by a huge landslide on Friday, as rocks are still falling and the ground is still shifting. The government says more than 2,000 people may have been buried alive on Sunday. A UN spokesman estimated about 670 may still be under the debris. Our Australia correspondent Katie Watson reports.
Help is desperately needed in Enga, but while people wait for it to arrive, there's nothing else for it. They're digging through debris with any tool they can find. Nearly 4 days on from the landslide, few bodies have been pulled from the rubble. While this family is able to bury their loved one, not many here are being afforded this moment. It was 3 a.m. on Friday when the landslide struck, wiping out well over 100 houses while residents were asleep. The final death toll won't be known for some time. In the interim, these numbers the authorities are giving can only be estimates. Added to that, the population swelled recently because of nearby tribal violence. That's also made the rescue effort harder. Getting to this remote part of Papua New Guinea with blocked roads and security threats is a challenge, and the conditions on the ground are still difficult. Papua New Guinea has called for international assistance. Neighbouring Australia has already responded, and humanitarian agencies are on the ground. But more help is needed in what's looking more like a recovery than a rescue mission. This is a community in mourning, and people are still waiting to say their goodbyes.
Katie Watson. Members of the World Health Organization are in Geneva for their annual assembly, and top of the agenda is how to make the world prepared for another pandemic. Pressure is growing to establish a global treaty aimed at correcting the mistakes highlighted by the spread of COVID-19 4 years ago. But so far, an agreement has not been reached. Our correspondent in Geneva, Imogen Folks, told me what a potential treaty would contain.
Well, the key aim, as you said, is to make sure we do a whole lot better than we did coping with COVID-19, which is widely viewed as pretty much a disaster as far as global cooperation goes. The key things in some of the drafts I've seen of this treaty are better surveillance of disease outbreaks, rapid binding pathogen sharing, especially things that could cause new diseases, that could cause major harm, and also key, the sharing of vaccines and treatments so that poor countries don't get left out as they did with COVID-19. Now, the World Health Organization set this pretty ambitious target of this month, May 2024, to get it done. And it was always going to be difficult because international treaties, especially ones like this, which would be legally binding, typically really do take many, many years. But public health experts, and they're here in Geneva for this assembly, are saying really another pandemic is inevitable. Suri Moon, who's professor of global health at Geneva's Graduate Institute, told me time is running out.
We need the meaningful outlines, the contours of a binding agreement to be accepted and endorsed by the end of May. Otherwise, I think we can have talks that drag on for years and years and years and could end up yielding nothing until, of course, the next crisis happens. And that's what we've seen time and time again.
And Imogen, as you said, scientists agree there will be another pandemic. So why the delay in agreeing a treaty?
The key obstacle is around that word sharing. It's a bit sad, really, given what we all went through in the COVID-19 pandemic. But wealthy countries are balking a bit at the suggestion that they should be legally obliged to set aside 20% of vaccines and treatments for poorer countries. They're talking about it maybe, you know, affecting their sovereignty. They want to be able to help their own populations first in the event of a pandemic. Now, developing countries who really missed out on the vaccines and treatments, they've been told they need to monitor disease outbreaks much better. That costs money. And they need to share the pathogens they identify. And they are saying, look, if we do this and we share the pathogens with wealthy countries where all the pharmaceutical industry is, they make the vaccines and they make the treatments and they make money out of that. And we don't get a guarantee of those vaccines and treatments. So that's pretty much the nub of the argument going on in Geneva. There is a slim chance we still might get a vague treaty, but I think the chances of a really ink dry on a hard and fast, legally binding treaty for meaningful global cooperation, I have to say there's not a lot of hope that we're going to see that by the end of this week.
Imogen Folks. Tourism is generally seen as a welcome economic boost, but the Spanish island of Mallorca is the latest holiday hotspot where locals have demonstrated against too much of it. On Saturday, 10,000 people marched through Palma holding posters reading SOS residents, enough mass tourism. And that unease is replicated throughout the Balearic Islands. Arantxa Fernández is a deputy for the Socialist Parliamentary Group in the Balearic Parliament.
Right now, it is impossible for a citizen from Ibiza or Mallorca to find a room or a flat to rent because around 60% of the total rents are only for summer season. Owners prefer to rent only to tourists because they earn more money renting 3 months through Airbnb than 12 months to a resident. So therefore, nobody wants to come here to work, and a lot of people born and raised here in Ibiza are living from the mainland.
To combat the problem elsewhere, Venice has introduced new tourist taxes. Cruise ships in Crete are being regulated. And in Japan, an iconic view of Mount Fuji has been blocked off after residents complained of the area being overrun by millions of tourists taking selfies. Simon Jack spoke to Peter De Bruyne, Senior Project Officer of UNESCO's World Heritage and Sustainable Tourism Programme.
Sustainable tourism really is where you have a balance between tourism and conservation and community well-being. And what we're seeing right now are thresholds being breached. I think that's really important. There's a tolerance that is no longer there in a lot of these communities. So that's the response we're getting.
Is that threshold that's being breached, is it to do with sort of property prices and locals not being able to afford to live in their own town? Or is it environmental with, you know, I don't know, cruise ships coming in and churning up the water? What are the thresholds that you're talking about?
I think it's all of them, actually. I think all of these things are happening at once. And the interesting thing, though, is that policymakers are responding, and that's what you're also seeing. So I think this is something that UNESCO really advocates, is unfettered tourism and is just not possible anymore. We need to be looking at how we can better manage it.
Okay, and what is the answer? You say that this policy lever is being pulled. What is it? Is that taxation? Is it discouraging people? What are some of the initiatives that people are looking at?
Well, I think fundamentally any destination wants to welcome tourists. And I think we really are focusing on how we can make that visitor experience better. Because chances are, if you're having a great experience, if it's not crowded, the destination is well managed. So I think that's something to really keep in mind. There is unfortunately no magic bullet. You know, each destination is different. Each destination is dealing with different pressures from tourism. And that's what we're seeing, is we're seeing different responses.
Yeah, because it's a real paradox, isn't it? Everyone wants to go to some unspoiled island until everyone discovers that it gets spoiled. But presumably a happier place where residents are happy to welcome you is a better experience for the traveller as well.
Absolutely. We always say better places to live or better places to visit. We're all travelers and we all want to go on holiday and we want to feel good. We don't want to feel guilty necessarily. But at the same time, I think consumer behavior is an area where we really need to focus and raise awareness so we can avoid some of these problems.
And just a final thought, because Airbnb comes up a lot in items around, for example, locals saying they're getting priced out of areas. It happens in coastal communities here in the UK. Does it come up a lot in your work?
Again, it's one of these things, this phenomenon that has, I think, kind of taken people by surprise. It's similar to right after the big financial crash in 2008 when many destinations were wanting more tourists to offset the financial devastation that was occurring. Okay. And that's where you saw the rise of low-cost airlines. So okay. low-cost airlines also have had a big impact on bringing people to a lot of destinations at a very low price. So it made it possible for a lot of people.
Peter De Bruin of UNESCO. Still to come, a well-known pop singer in Thailand is sentenced to jail for insulting the monarchy there. And
if a battery pack is smaller, the cost of the manufacturing of that car is significantly less.
How to keep the cost of an electric car down. South Africa goes to the polls on Wednesday, but those who've registered for special votes can cast their ballots from today. President Cyril Ramaphosa made the announcement in a television address to the nation on Sunday evening, which was criticised by the opposition for being a campaign speech. Rob Young heard more from the BBC's Catherine Bierahanga in Johannesburg.
His tone at the beginning was statesmanlike. He praised the institutions of South Africa, especially the Electoral Commission, ahead of early voting beginning today. But then he went on to talk about the successes of his ANC government. And there has been some reaction from South Africans who felt uneasy about the president, they say, using his platform, his official state platform as president, to campaign for South Africans. But his message to South Africans was to give his party yet another term in office. This would be its seventh term in office. At the moment, there have been questions as to whether his government has done enough to erode corruption, to help build state services such as electricity, health. So this was his message to the country.
When this administration took office in 2019, our country stood at a turning point. We had endured a decade of corruption and state capture, of weak economic growth, and the erosion of our public institutions. Today, we have put that era behind us. We've placed South Africa on a new trajectory of recovery and laid a strong foundation for future growth. The last 5 years have been a time of rebuilding and recovery. As this sixth administration draws to a close, and as we prepare for the seventh administration, let us build on the progress that we have made.
South Africa's president and the leader of the ANC there, Cyril Ramaphosa. And Catherine, he was arguing that the ANC are part of the solution to South Africa's problems. But are voters likely to give them another term in power to try to turn things around?
This is a difficult time for many South Africans. Rob, as you know, the unemployment rate in the country stands at 30%, one of the highest in the world. And when it comes to young people, that rate is at 50%. There are chronic problems in the health facilities. South Africans have to wait sometimes up to 6 hours to see a medical practitioner. So all of that is impacting the ANC's popularity. But it's important to say that this is the party of Nelson Mandela, Winnie Mandela. It has cemented its position within South African history and bringing down the apartheid regime. So it's still incredibly popular. But nevertheless, opposition parties see an opportunity. First of all, the main opposition party, the DA, has created what it calls the multi-party charter, a coalition of 10 parties. They say that if they get enough votes, more than 50%, they will be able to dislodge the ANC. There's also the prospect that the ANC could, if it loses its majority in parliament, turn to these parties individually to create a coalition. The DA, despite being a long-time opposition party, has not discounted joining a coalition with the ANC, but they say they need some concessions. I spoke to Solly Misanga. He is the DA's local representative for Gauteng province.
We're not going to prep them up, you know, to continue with the failings that they actually initiated. If there cannot be about an open capital-led economy in South Africa, the state-owned entities that have fallen apart, whether you're talking South African Airways, whether you're talking about DINEL, you're talking about Eskom with electricity producers, and so many others that have fallen. If you're talking about the policies around land usage and land ownership, which has really not been one of their strong fortes, this is why we've had so much people who are uneasy about investing. So these are things that we have said to them, look, these are things that needs to be changed and this needs to be addressed. us. And unfortunately, if they're not willing to then engage and talk to those things, then we can't have a conversation with them.
Solly Musanga there. So, Catherine, we mentioned before that early voting is beginning on Monday. Any indication on what turnout is likely to be, not just today, but on Wednesday? And when will we know the result?
At the last election, the turnout was around 66%. But the worry is that perhaps there has been some voter apathy that has set in amongst South Africans, especially supporters of the ANC. It's not rare to hear on the radio, on the television, ANC supporters saying they're disappointed with the party and they might not want to vote for another organisation or party, but they'll probably stay at home. So the worry is that the voter turnout could reduce and that will impact parties across the board. The latest polling shows that the ANC will win about 40% of the vote. That is drastically lower than the 57% that it's won at the last election.
Catherine Bierahanga in Johannesburg. And now to Thailand.
Mi pa hom ge kong mai at to me tai shan un te ben on.
The Thai pop singer Chaimon Kabibunpan, his music sounds innocuous enough, but his popularity hasn't been enough to save him from Thailand's draconian Les Majesty laws designed to protect the dignity of the monarchy. Our Asia Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me more.
Today, there were two big court decisions. That pop singer you just mentioned, Chaimon Kabibunpan, he's been sentenced to 4 years in prison for spray painting on a portrait of the very powerful Thai king, Wajira Longkorn. We should say the singer, he protested this. He said he shouldn't have been sentenced and found guilty of Thailand's Les Majesty laws, which outlaw any criticism of the monarchy, because he says he was just frustrated that fellow activists were being detained. That's during some really important protests that really started in 2020 when young people across Thailand were questioning why the monarchy is allowed to be so powerful. Also, the court today sentenced a very popular opposition MP, a politician, Chontita Jangreo. Now, she gave a speech questioning why the king and the palace are allowed to spend taxpayers' money really without any oversight. And for that, she's been sentenced to 2 years in prison, although she's appealing it. And for now, she'll be out on bail.
And are these very draconian Les Majesty laws, are they being used more often in Thailand to silence dissent?
Absolutely, Val. Since 2020, since those protests that I mentioned kicked off, we've seen those laws being used 270 times. That's according to Thai human rights groups. And in January, we saw one man sentenced to 50 years in prison from some Facebook posts that he wrote. So this all is happening at a really sensitive time in Thailand. Just a couple of weeks ago, another high-profile pro-democracy activist died in detention after carrying out a few hunger strikes. And also, the party that won the most votes in Thailand's election last year, the Move Forward Party, there's actually a petition to dissolve that entire party. They were basically outmaneuvered out of power by more conservative forces. And now there's a move to dissolve the entire party, even though they won the most votes, because a constitutional court in Thailand has found that the fact that they were calling for amendments to those strict laws, the Les Majesty laws that we've been talking about, could overthrow the entire political order. So a lot of political tensions right now in Thailand regarding those laws.
Celia Hatton, now what would persuade more of us to take up driving electric vehicles? Well, it's a question governments and manufacturers are asking all around the world and are trying to address. One of those is Silicon Valley-based Lucid, a luxury EV startup. Will Bain spoke to its British boss, Peter Rawlinson.
We need to address some of the fundamental barriers to adoption. And right now, we've addressed range anxiety. We have a car with over 500 miles range. But the next big hurdle is the sheer cost of an electric car. And that, unlike a petrol engine car, is dominated by the cost of a battery pack. And what Lucid is doing is it's creating technology which enables the car to go further with less battery. And if we can do that, we can create electric cars with smaller battery packs. And if the battery pack is smaller, the cost of the manufacturing of that car is significantly less.
I'm interested in the route that you've gone, going high-end first. One of the arguments that people have made about the success of BYD, for example, the Chinese competitor, is that they kind of went the other way around. Mm-hmm. They got the kind of mass market model out there first.
Paradoxically, the cost of industrializing many products is inversely proportional to the cost of the product. As a startup, we had to attract initial investment. It wasn't on to go from a mass market. Now, if you look at BYD, it's a completely inverted economics there, because you've got an industry which is heavily subsidized by Chinese government. For us, we wanted to start high. It enables us to develop the core technology, and also it establishes a brand. It's awfully difficult to establish a brand low down and push it up.
In the way the playing field is currently set up, can companies like Lucid possibly compete with the BYDs?
It's not a level playing field. You've got labour rates which are artificially low, and then you've got heavily supported government incentives for a company like BYD. I think the Chinese car industry has advanced immeasurably. Their inherent ability to design, develop and manufacture cars, I still think they're many years behind on the core EV technology, but I've no doubt they'll get there.
Peter Rawlinson. The BBC has learned that the FBI has been investigating the sale to US buyers of hundreds of treasures the British Museum believes were stolen from its collection. The museum confirmed in August that a large number of objects were missing. A police investigation continues here in the UK. Here's our culture editor, Katie Razzell.
Is a pencil? Shouldn't it be a pen?
I'm in a wood-panelled staff room inside the British Museum with the Danish antiquities dealer, Dr. Itai Gradel.
It is a pen.
I promise you it's not a pencil.
Oh, right. You're right. You're
rubbish. He's sitting next to Professor Tom Harrison, who's leading the museum's recovery programme. And he's signing more than 350 ancient gemstones over to the museum, items they and he believe were stolen.
I haven't practiced it from home.
Itai bought hundreds of gems in good faith over many years, mainly through the online auction site eBay and via another dealer. The museum's announcement last August about missing, stolen and damaged items wasn't news to Dr. Gradel. He had first tried to warn more than 2 years before that he believed a curator was stealing from its collection. He was brushed off by the museum several times. Former Chancellor George Osborne is the chair of trustees.
Was there an effort made to protect the reputation of the museum? People have called it a cover-up.
I absolutely reject that. There are people who made mistakes, there are people who may have been naive, but there was no deliberate attempt to conceal from the public what had happened.
The museum claims its curator, Dr. Peter Higgs, who's been sacked, sold its treasures to at least 45 buyers on eBay. Peter Higgs denies any wrongdoing. The police are investigating. But since the story broke, we've been on the hunt for hundreds of treasures that appear scattered across the world. Itai Gradel has located objects he sold on in Hamburg, Cologne, Hong Kong and Paris, where I joined him for a handover of four gems.
What a place.
OK.
It's the moment.
Yep, there they are.
We've also found two gems on display in a temporary exhibition in another museum in a small town in Germany. That museum would have had no idea that they may have been stolen. And we've discovered that the FBI has been investigating sales made in the US.
I got an email from the FBI. I was completely shocked. I don't want any trouble.
That's Tonio Barbiglia, a former gem dealer based in New Orleans. He told us an FBI agent contacted him about items he'd bought on eBay.
I didn't have anything to hide. I gladly spoke with him.
We've since established that Tonio bought two gems, one depicting the god of desire Cupid, the other the Egyptian god Anubis.
That was when I was working for a really big antique store, which is known for big antiques in New Orleans. And they had specific clients that were looking for things like seals and things like that.
Tonio hasn't heard anything from the FBI since then, But we understand the US law enforcement agency located more than 260 gems believed to have come from the British Museum that were bought by a private collector in Washington, D.C. We believe those gems are now back at the museum. But the museum's recovery program is hindered by a lack of cataloguing. It doesn't have a record of many of the items, which means the museum hasn't yet been able to prove they were actually stolen. Professor Harrison replaced Peter Higgs as the head of the Greece and Rome department.
We're looking at the registers, old archive material, which includes receipts, lists that were made before the items came here.
The museum will now spend £10 million fully cataloguing its collection, and it says it's on its way to recovering almost half of what it estimates is missing. But it's likely gold jewellery and other items have already been melted down and will never be recovered.
Katie Razzle. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sid Dundon and the producer was Judy Frankel. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.